This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent, CBS News. And we are joined by two of the youngest power brokers in all of Washington, D.C. Jake Sherman, 32, Anna Palmer, 35. They are the authors of The Political Playbook. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the power structures, as we frequently do in this show. And one of those power structures, as I'm sure you and our audience appreciate, is the journalistic subculture in Washington, D.C. How does that function? What does it aspire to do? How does it use its platform to inform and bring to the surface information about what's going on, not only visibly in Washington, D.C., but behind the scenes? And Political Playbook specializes in that exact kind of journalism. So we are at District Taco. It's breakfast time. Very shortly, very, very shortly, this host is going to be extremely happy because we're going to have breakfast tacos. The salsa, for those of you watching on CBSN, already arrayed in front of us, tempting us as it is. But we'll get to the tacos in a second. Jake Sherman, Anna Palmer, welcome to the Takeout Podcast microphones. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you. The salsa is quite tempting.
Yes, exactly. And when the tacos get here, it'll all be mixed together. So I want to play for our audience a soundbite from way back when, 2007, when this entity came upon the journalistic scene in Washington known as Politico. Here's what it said about itself in early 2007. Arden, if you please.
Anyone in Washington can talk politics, but not everyone knows politics down to its core. The Politico. All the capital news you need to know. Now available wherever you go. Get The Politico. Going live January 23rd.
Sounds kind of quaint.
I can tell you I've never heard that before.
Isn't that charming?
That was something. I've never heard that.
That's the ad department of 2007 getting all up in your face, right?
Jazzed up about Politico.
We need a new one of those.
Exactly. So tell our audience, Anna and Jake, whichever way you want to go first, what is the playbook and how does it fit within the culture of Politico itself and the Washington news flow?
Sure. So Playbook and Politico kind of grew together, right? I mean, Playbook was started by our former colleague, who you know well, Mike Allen. Mm-hmm. It was started as just a note to the newsroom leadership about what was happening in D.C. that day.
An internal document.
Right. Yeah. And then quickly, or quite quickly, you know, campaigns started hearing about it and asking for it. Both, I think, the Clinton campaign, the Obama campaign, the McCain campaign. And then we opened it up, or they opened it up. I wasn't there at the time, to the public. And it really gained extreme prominence when Mark Leibovich wrote a cover story on Mike and Playbook for the New York Times Magazine in, I think, 2010 or 11.
Letting the nation know this is a thing, and here's why.
Yeah, basically what we try to do is we try to be the Cliff Notes to Washington. But we are maniacally focused on inside the Beltway news. We are maniacally focused on what the chief of staff to the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader need to know, what the White House chief of staff needs to know, who is seen with whom, and what does it mean for D.C.?
And I think what you alluded to earlier, right, it is the inside game. It's for and about Washington unapologetically. It's about the people behind the scenes, the people who have the power. And so it's almost kind of like the town crier
in some
ways.
And how they use the power, right?
Right. And, I mean, it's birthdays, it's spotted. But it's also, we really have tried in the year and a half that we've been there, is we're reporters, we worked on the Hill for a long time, is to break news, to kind of set the tone of the day for what's going to happen.
You just said a word that I want our audience to make sure they heard correctly. You said spotted.
Yeah.
That is a colloquialism for Playbook.
And what is spotted? Because it is a big part of this culture of the political playbook.
It is. We have different feelings about it on different days depending on who it is. But it's who's lunching with who, who's at the Four Seasons for breakfast, and what does that mean about a deal that might or might not happen, or what does it mean about the D.C. social structure? I mean, I think...
And that's important because if you're spotted, you might be part of something that's important in the future.
Yeah, politics and policy is all about personality in Washington. And we live in a weird ecosystem where aides to members of Congress and lobbyists and operatives for companies and for campaigns have outsized importance. Don't you think that's right, Anna?
Yeah, and I would say I think one of the interesting things about a spotted is it can really kind of peel back the layers. I think often what's on TV or what people's perception of what happens in the Capitol is everyone hates everyone. It's so partisan. You know, if you're a Republican, you only hang out with Republicans. If you're a Democrat, you only hang out with Democrats. And a lot of what the spotted show is, no, these people are having cocktails together. They're having breakfast together. There is this kind of ecosystem that lives on beyond just the daily partisan bickering.
And how does a spotted become a spotted?
That's a good question. That's a science. It's more of an art than a science.
I would imagine. Because you're not spotting everyone who's spotted on a day-to-day basis.
No. People
let you know that they have been spotted or that they were at a certain place?
They do. There are people who spot themselves.
Yes.
And it's an inside joke within the Playbook family about who those people are. We will not reveal any of those.
There's some repeaters, I'm guessing.
Oh, there certainly are.
Self-promotion is not a
lost art in Washington, D.C.
No, and you have to be careful with them, right? Because people have agendas, and you don't want to spot we have made mistakes, and we've thought somebody is somebody else, and we've trusted somebody who was not trustworthy.
Making a representation of what they saw.
Or misidentifying someone. Right. Sometimes it's innocent. But we do ask people to snap photos. Yesterday, someone spotted someone on a flight from Palm Beach to D.C., and I said, could you snap a photo? And they said, no, I can't. And I didn't know the guy. So,
right.
I mean,
so you don't use
we're
it.
Journalists.
I mean, you have to be careful.
We're not TMZ all the time.
Exactly. Is there a danger about the insularity of Washington taking over itself and that idea that a spotted becomes a kind of thing that is representative possibly of something, but also misses some larger things that the country is concerned about? Is it most important that someone is at the Four Seasons or that the structural deficit or debt or the healthcare situation is large or small or getting better or worse? Is there an insularity danger there?
Sure, but I would say I think we try to give weight to certain spotteds that are important and less weight to others. So I think you can see that in the hierarchy of where they are in the newsletter and whether or not we mention them at all. You know, I think we try to just use it as a factor of illuminating the larger context of what's happening here, less of, yes, the massive debt or, you know, the massive problems that this country has.
And also the top of Playbook today, I mean, Playbook is also a newsletter, right?
Yes.
It is an analytical newsletter that seeks to both drive conversation, illuminate the inner workings of Washington, and explain things to people who need them explained to. Like, for example, the top third of Playbook this morning was about the immigration fight and the government funding fight and the dynamics that are playing out in the Capitol, very important dynamics that are going to affect millions of people.
Ever-shifting. And they're shifting by the hour and by the appearance of the President of the United States.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a page six element to Playbook, but there's also a weighty news element to Playbook as well.
And one of the things I think the Playbook and this show have in common is a constant desire to explain and demystify things that the rest of the country may not comprehend about terminology, methods, and procedures in Washington, about the way things get through the system or don't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a lot of our job, right, is to kind of be the decoder of what is happening here. And oftentimes it's not, you know, this isn't rocket science, but it really is peeling back what are the motivations, who's going to meet with whom, and what's going to probably be the likely outcome.
Like you said earlier, how relationships may or may not affect the outcome, what they knew about each other or learned about each other in a previous legislative engagement or clash.
And also, like, I think of an example of how a kind of a social or society item is important. The Trump administration, the president and his team and aides and friends told the American people during the campaign they weren't going to be one with Washington. They were going to hire outsiders. They weren't going to deal with lobbyists. Their aides weren't going to become lobbyists. Well, a lot of them have. They are all social creatures in Washington. They are all becoming part and parcel to this town, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
And that is important in the context of understanding Donald Trump. Don't you think so, Anna?
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. And I think the other thing I would say is I think, you know, one of the things we just try to do is connect a lot of the dots and also be the truth tellers. We, I think, have no problem calling BS on something just because, you know, the speaker says it or because the president says it. If it's not actually true, we often do that. We try to say, no, actually, this is never going to happen. Your timeline can't happen.
And before we go to break, because this is really important, how do people get it?
Oh, they go to politico.com/playbook to subscribe. Or they could just email me at jake@politico.com, and I will be glad to put them on the list. I will not give out Anna's email, although it's public, so maybe I can.
Anna@politico.com.
There we go. That's Jake and Anna. I'm Major Garrett. You're listening to The Takeout.
We hope that 2018 will be a year of more bipartisan cooperation.
We truly do believe that there are opportunities after our discussions this weekend for bipartisan work on a broad range of issues, from infrastructure to workforce to vocational education.
With that being said, I think we're going to go bipartisan. I think we're going to have some really great bipartisan bills.
That's what we call in the trade a montage of sound. The first voice you heard, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The second voice, you probably recognized it, but in case you did not, Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States. And I'm relatively certain you recognize the third voice. That would be the 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump. Yes, indeed. This is The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett. You already knew that. Our guest this week for episode 52, Jake Sherman, Anna Palmer, the daily authors of the Politico Playbook. So, bipartisanship. All that was said this week, this last weekend, January 6th, Camp David, and all the people talking about bipartisanship were meeting in a partisan way with themselves, Republicans. Jake and Anna, what do you think, based on not only your experience as reporters, but your antennae at this particular time of season in Washington early? It's kind of like the beginning of every baseball season. Everyone's got a chance, at least theoretically, to win the World Series. Is there a real genuine chance for bipartisanship?
I would say no.
Okay.
That's pretty depressing. But, I mean, I think, listen, it's the kumbaya moment where they want to say that kind of a thing. But we are clearly headed into, very quickly, political 2018 midterms. Republicans have done nothing so far. If you look at tax reform, if you look at what they did on health care, to actually reach across the aisle, it's hard to see them do that now when they're talking about entitlement reform or infrastructure.
I mean, listen, if they do, I agree with Anna completely, but they've already kind of ruled out infrastructure, which is would have a chance at least of being bipartisan in concept. They're kind of bearish on infrastructure. And
in that, Republicans and Democrats have said publicly over and over they are open to and interested by the idea of improving roads, bridges, ports, and other core components of American infrastructure.
But they say they said the same thing about tax reform. Both right. Democrats and Republicans would say, we believe the tax rate needs to be lower. And then you saw what happened.
Right. All Republicans, no Democrats.
I will say I was speaking to somebody yesterday in the context of writing our book, which comes out in 2019 about Congress.
We love to talk about future books.
Yes.
Show,
well, I wish
it's
I had
a good plug.
I said this to the other day. I said this to somebody on the air. I don't have a link yet, but when I do, I will
exactly.
Trump it in.
Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, authored by me. Mid-September, bookstores near you.
And
Major.
Amazon.
Fantastic.
Hey, thank you, Mr. President.
If they do something on opioid addiction, if there's some sort of big opioid addiction bill, something to help the opioid epidemic around the country, that's something that I could see Democrats getting on board. And I really do believe there will be something on that, because that is an issue that affects every district. It's a great, and let's speak crassly about it, if they do it, it's a big political victory for people who vote
and,
for
and,
it.
And a necessary step that the federal government has not taken that is overdue.
Right.
States will tell you that. Law enforcement will tell you that. Emergency rooms will tell you that. Everyone who is dealing with the downstream real-life effects of opiate and opioid addiction and all the things that manifest from it, most of which are horrible, need the federal government to do something either about pricing, the availability of those drugs which can intervene to save people in crisis, or to dramatically increase federal support for either addiction counseling or addiction treatment, all of those things.
And you saw Rob Portman when he ran for re-election 2016.
Ohio Republican
right,
senator.
Yep. He ran and spoke a lot about opioid addiction and made it a centerpiece of his campaign and won by a large margin in a tough race.
Yeah, I mean, it's also one of the few areas where you've had House Republicans and House Democrats come together on bills this
right.
year so far.
So one thing that for our CBSN audience, the food has arrived, and it's just sitting there.
No, I ate a breakfast taco already.
Okay, good. All right. Moving Jake, fast. Well done. So we're just going to dig in, and everyone should know that breakfast tacos far superior to donuts. for breakfast.
I'll have a second one. Whatever.
There we go. Yeah.
Jake is breaking his no carb rule.
No, I don't usually eat carbohydrates, but
that's right.
You know. Yeah, and the one thing we do need, Alex, please, is that that box of napkins. Yeah, that's going to come in handy. There we go. There we go. So, District Taco is our very hospitable breakfast host. We're glad to be here. Let me read to you something before I take a huge bite of my chorizo breakfast taco. Something that was said by President Trump. Didn't say it when he was president, but he said it in 2015. It was on Twitter. You might be surprised to hear that. It was on Twitter. It reads as follows. The money-losing Politico is considered by many in the world of politics to be the dumbest and most slanted of the political sites. Losers. He also said on Twitter, really dishonest. Oh, and this one. Really get you where you live. Pure scum.
That's not nice. No.
But it's almost a nickname.
Pure scum. Well, listen.
As opposed to diluted, you know, and not pure.
I'm always surprised by how much time, and we were talking about this a little bit off camera and off mic, how much time the president spends talking about the media. It's stunning. And the president is in almost constant search of elite approval, whether it's from the New York Times or talking about CNN or any of the networks or any of the cable, you know, the cables and newspapers, and Politico's one of them. And it's what I always tell people who are Trump supporters is it's mostly an act, because he does talk to many journalists, both off the record and on the record, and his administration leaks. He leaks. So it's mostly a get up. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I mean, I think Politico was one of the first, if not the first outlet that was actually banned from his rallies when he was a candidate. And then that became obviously a very big storyline through the campaign when the Post and others were also...
Washington Post
were also banned. You know, I think we talk a lot about what effect this might have, right? And so far on Capitol Hill with senators, with lawmakers, you know, you often hear the president deriding us as fake news and, you know, why would you talk to them, even though, as Jake said, he does. You don't see that trickling down to the Capitol.
Ever.
I think lawmakers, Republicans in particular, even the most conservative that you might think would be very in a Trumpian kind of mode, use the press, talk to us, respect us. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it's their own viability as a candidate and as a lawmaker is to get their name in the press.
Right. I think, Major, you've had this experience too, but on Capitol Hill, and this is something that Anna, we've all experienced, reporters live among members of Congress. We eat in the same cafeterias that they do in many cases. We walk the halls. We have free reign over the... We have more...
It's a lot of access.
We have more access than most staff members on
Absolutely.
Capitol Hill. I've been covering Republicans almost exclusively for 8 years, and I've never in my 8 years had anybody say fake news or I mean, people get angry about stories,
right.
But so do Democrats. Everyone gets angry. Athletes get angry about stories.
Sure. Let me ask you a question that throughout my career I've gotten from friends and family who really don't understand our business, and they say, how do you make a story? What's a story? How does that happen? Now, to go into the exact layout of playbook, how do you decide? How do you prioritize? How do you look at it on a daily, and you do it twice a day? It's important for audience to understand it. It comes out in the morning, and there's a updated in the afternoon. So you're going through two editorial processes. How does that work?
It's
not an easy question to answer. Grant you.
But we've spent our entire career as daily reporters, meaning we get to the Capitol in the morning, find out what the story we're going to write is by noon, file it by 6,
right.
And then go home and have a glass of wine and fall asleep. Right. But when you're doing playbook,
boy, do I know that line.
Yeah, you know, when you're doing playbook, it's a combination of a lot. I mean, we're up at 3:30 or 4, and we start. Two of our colleagues work kind of a little bit earlier than that and help prepare what we call like the B matter of the playbook, which is in layman's terms, it's the secondary material,
right.
not the news and analysis that we have, but the look around, 360 view look around the media landscape.
And then you look for two or three very punchy things at the top to set the stage for the morning read, right?
Yes. And what we try to do is we try to be in touch with sources all across, people close to the White House, people in the White House, people on Capitol Hill, lobbyists, people in the media, about what we could do to either explain something that needs explaining or drive the conversation in another way. And a lot of the times it's staff moves. For example, this morning we had an item, Jamie Rubin, who is a Clinton-era State Department official,
right,
is moving back to Washington and joining a law firm, a lobbying shop that is started by Brian Ballard, a close Trump ally. So
what does that mean, and what it
might
mean?
And so that's the kind of thing that D.C. cares about.
That's Jake Sherman. He's with Anna Palmer. I'm Major Garrett. You're listening to The Takeout. More on the Politico Playbook when we come back.
You're listening to The Takeout.
What a delicious breakfast we're having here at District Taco. I'm Major Garrett, joined by Jake Sherman and Anna Palmer of Politico's Playbook. They're the authors. We'll get back to them in a second. I've got some business to take care of here. Very important takeout business. First of all, some of you listening on great radio stations around the country, we thank you for that. Many of you have brought this podcast into your home on podcast platforms. New episodes of this show, The Takeout, are available every Friday morning, and we invite you most earnestly to subscribe, rate, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us. And you know, you can like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. As you also know, and Jake, here's one.
Ooh,
Anna,
wow.
Here's yours.
This
the
is
the only
great
piece of swag the Takeout Podcast currently has, but we're going to work on that. We're going to enlarge the swag merchandise catalog.
Yeah.
In 2018, Takeout Podcast sticker signed by the one and only, and that's probably good for the world that there is only one and only Major Garrett. There's one way and one way only that you can obtain this sticker, and you might be fascinated to know that it's kind of, well, old school.
Uh-oh.
Old school. This is how you do it. If you are interested in obtaining this sticker, this is what you have to do. Send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News, at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036. That is a self-addressed stamped envelope. Can't send us an email. Can't communicate with us on Twitter or Facebook or any of those other amazing social media platforms. You gotta go through the 1970s snail mail self-addressed stamped envelope. And so far, more than 400 people have done precisely that from every state in our great country and 11 countries not named the United States of America.
That's amazing.
Grassroots, baby.
Keeping the mail system going.
we here at The Takeout are trying to keep the U.S. Postal Service alive and well.
Seems it.
And the letters that come in are sometimes kind of
amazing.
They're kind of really cool. So here's one. From Stephanie Rojo from Poway, California, very near my hometown of San Diego, she writes, I have recently become quite the fan of The Takeout, and I think I've become a reliable enough fan to request a sticker. Most certainly you have, Stephanie, and it will be en route very shortly. Stay honest, my friends, and I'll stay tuned. P.S., I'm very pregnant, and rumor has it the baby can hear what's going on in the outside world. Needless to say, I think I'm also giving you your smallest fan. Good teamwork. Stephanie, we could not agree more.
Wow.
And to the baby on the way, we wish you nothing but happiness and many, many healthy and happy returns. Another letter to The Takeout. Greetings from Canada. Greetings from Canada. Ever since I canceled my cable subscription, you're probably not alone, good sir. I have been using CBSN. We have a sound effect for that. As my source of U.S. news, news that seriously impacts Canada and the rest of the world. Your Takeout podcast helps me try to understand points of view that may be different from my own. We certainly do try to do that. You are setting a great example of how it is possible to listen to a point of view for the value of its merits. We try to do that each and every week. Not only have I sent you a self-addressed stamped envelope, but also a photo of where it will go on my much-traveled cello case.
Wow.
The exact location, depending on size of the sticker, could be just below Iowa alumni. That's right up here. We'll show this later on CBSN. Just above Brazil or below Polska. And for those of you not necessarily aware, Polska means Poland. Thanks for the actual dialogue you are bringing to these divisive times. David Evanchik from Canada. We suspect probably from Toronto because one of our staffers is from Canada and says that there are a lot of cellists in Toronto. But I don't know for sure. Anyway, Dave, thanks for the letter. Thanks to all of you for writing The Takeout. And all who write will, of course, receive the much-cherished Takeout podcast sticker. So that's all the business.
That's nice.
We had to take care of.
I like that.
So this, as you said, Anna, at the top of the show, is a Politico year and a political year, 2018. It's a midterm cycle. Now, many in our audience would say to themselves, yes, but that's not till November. My goodness, why can't we do work for the country and not get so rapidly into these hardcore political calculations and anxieties? Can't we wait? And could you help them try to understand why that is or is not or may not be possible?
I think a lot of people would say that, right? If you go, I'm from North Dakota. If I go back home, you know, all they say is, all you guys do is campaign, right? You're never actually doing the governing that needs to happen in this country to make it a better place. I think the reality is that the minute the election happens, members of Congress and even the president are running for their reelection. Anything they do is kind of precipitated based on that, but they're also fundraising. They're also looking at, you know, who their potential challengers are going to be. I mean, a lot of it is raising money. And we were talking before, I mean, look at the House, right? You have 31 seats open. You have
31 Republican,
well, Republican seats
side,
open
right.
on the Republican side. And you have...
And an open seat means they're not seeking reelection.
Correct. Sorry, yes. So there is just, there's this kind of almost... feeling that you can't get away from, that Republicans feel like they're going to lose control of the House and they just don't know by how much. And so everything, every move is coordinated based on that feeling. Don't you think, Jake?
And sort of filtered through that lens of anxiety.
For sure. I can't tell you. I watch a lot of votes from the House gallery, which overlooks, it's a balcony that overlooks the House floor that's you could get into if you're in the public, but it's if you're a reporter, there's a special area with desks, and we all know that, but maybe
it's a wonderful perch to watch the American government. I love it. I mean, being in the House and the Senate is a wonderful, wonderful place to be a reporter.
Yeah, and you get to see who's talking to who, and you see, I always notice there are a lot of vulnerable members of Congress who are politically vulnerable.
Congregating.
Who look up at the board and see how their peers are voting, and see how maybe somebody in a neighboring district is voting, or how somebody on the other side of the aisle is voting. So, everything is viewed through a lens of getting power, keeping power, and increasing power.
And help our audience understand what you just described, because that's really fascinating, Jake, this idea of looking at the board. What I've discovered, and I'm sure this was always true, but it seems to be more true as I've covered Congress longer and longer, and I started doing that way back in 1990, if you can believe it. Part of the leadership responsibility to the conference itself was to not put things up on that board in the first place that make their members nervous or politically vulnerable.
And it's not only that, it's also to put things on the floor that will help members of Congress get reelection. I overheard a conversation between, I don't know if I should say this, maybe I won't, but between two, a Republican and Democratic
come on, go for it.
Congressional leader. And I'll just say, I mean, Kevin McCarthy and Steny Hoyer talking about a bill, and I heard Kevin McCarthy say, this
House
is
Majority Leader?
Yeah.
Steny Hoyer, the right. House Minority Whip?
Right, the number... two House Republican and House Democrat talking about a bill, and Kevin McCarthy said this vulnerable member has this bill and they're going to take it to the floor. Meaning this somebody who has a tough reelection, he wants them to get the credit for having their name on the bill, right, which is their responsibility, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a facet of government.
And to help our audience understand, things can't happen unless it gets to the floor. And that process of how it gets to the floor is part of this dynamic. And one of the things that your Politico playbook tries to understand and as it moves along, explain to people that that's what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're talking about kind of parochial issues that are smaller that maybe would be a win in a district that they can go back and have a press release and have the local news focus on. But I think the bigger issue that kind of underscores all of this is the nervousness about some of these big ticket items, which is funding the government. Republicans can't get away from that. And there's a lot of fiscal conservatives that said that they weren't going to raise the debt. They weren't going to raise the deficit. And they're going to be in a really tough position here in 8 days when they have to do that.
Let's talk about that. And 8 days is kind of, for this podcast, because it lives for many days, not absolute 8 days, but it's coming up. And we have a minute before we go to the break. But that the budget and avoiding a shutdown will have to be a bipartisan solution, will it not?
Most likely. Republicans could do it on their own, but they have some problems. defense hawks want more money for the military. As does the president. If defense hawks don't get that in a short-term government funding bill, they might revolt and not vote for it. But yes.
Meanwhile, Democrats say if you're going to do that, we need more on the domestic non-defense side.
And we need an immigration deal to protect 800,000 people brought to this country as children illegally. So it's a very complex
mix of issues. So these things are converging, and at some point, bipartisanship is going to need to exist, and we may have bipartisanship just for another month to keep trying to work this out, right?
Correct. And then you have some conservatives who say, wait, I wasn't elected to cut a deal with Democrats. I was elected to cut a deal with only Republicans. So you have all sorts of cross currents of things going on at once, which makes this very complicated.
Lots of cross currents in Washington, D.C. We try to demystify them as best we can. I'm Major Garrett. This is The Takeout, and we thank you for listening.
You're listening to The Takeout.
I'm Major Garrett. We're at District Taco right downtown Washington, D.C. Thoroughly enjoying. I think I will speak for all of us. Our breakfast tacos. I know I am. Jake Sherman, are you?
I am, begrudgingly, because of my lack of carbohydrates in my diet. But you know what? when you're on the takeout, you have to bend the
rules. Indulge. Yeah, you know, indulge fully. Anna?
Yeah, I love them. I would have Mexican food for breakfast every day.
There we go. That's exactly the right answer. So I mentioned in the last segment our takeout podcast stickers, of which we are very, very proud, and our audience tends to love them. Actually, the sticker came up in kind of an odd and unexpected way. I didn't even hear. I was witnessing this. It was at the White House earlier this week. Kevin McCarthy, mentioned before by Jake Sherman, House Majority Leader and recent guest, recent member of the Hall of Participants of the Takeout Podcast. And I was trying to get the Majority Leader's attention to ask him a question about immigration policy. Arden, will you play what happened next?
Oh, yes, sir. He gave me a sticker.
And then four called on me.
There you go.
He gave me a sticker.
People really do love the sticker.
I got a question because we traffic and take out podcast stickers. So that's about immigration and a meeting that was fascinating at the White House, not because it happened, but because it was televised. And we'll get into that in a second. Let's play Arden, a television correspondent that earlier this week tried to summarize the parts of that meeting.
California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein tempted the president with a bill that would only deal with DACA.
What about a clean DACA bill now, and with a commitment that we go into a comprehensive immigration reform?
For a moment, Mr. Trump appeared willing.
We're going to come up with DACA. We're going to do DACA, and then we can start immediately on the phase two, which would be comprehensive.
Then House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, mindful of conservative opposition, redirected the president.
Mr. President, you need to be clear, though. I think what Senator Feinstein's asking here, when we talk about just DACA, we don't want to be back here 2 years later. You have to have security, as the secretary would tell you.
But I think that's what you're saying.
I think you're saying DACA without security.
Wow, that correspondent was really on it. That was
beautiful.
It needs a bonus,
huge,
clearly.
Yes. Huge.
Excuse me. I've watched you on television. You're a real beauty.
Indeed, that's true. So let's get to what that was about. This was in the cabinet room. More than nearly two dozen lawmakers, Republican and Democrat, House and Senate, were there around the table with the president. And having covered five presidents, I've never seen a scenario where there is a conversation that is televised for 55 minutes about an of any topic, anything, you know, and it was about immigration. Some of it was posturing, but as that illustrated, some of it was actually dickering in real time over what might or might be the way to proceed and how to go. What did you think of that amazing near hour long fly on the wall moment that all of Washington got to enjoy?
I would say two things. One, the power of Trump. Man, he understands television and understands the media and how to play us. The fact that everybody covered it 55 minutes.
Took it live.
As soon as it was available. Right.
And the second thing, I mean, truly, this is like Trump, and Jay kind of put this in playbook today. Like, this was Trump's like West Wing moment. Like, he thought he was going to come in, they were going to have this massive moment, and then a deal. Yes, there was some dickering, but I mean, for the most part, it was a pretty show.
Yeah,
and we said this yesterday in playbook, I think, the days blend together, but
boy, do they ever.
They really do. Nothing changed. People are still in their same positions. They're still in their same corners. it was good television, but it kind of betrays a cartoonish view of Washington, like Anna said. It's like, just because you got people in the same room doesn't mean that the other 400 members of Congress are going to fall in line.
Did you find anything about that that was possibly helpful to your average reader or our average listener or viewer who just watches that and at least gets a chance to see members of Congress, if not clash and not resolve things, but at least articulate their points of view in a format like that? Did you think that, or do you think, well, you can see that when you watch any C-SPAN hearing or watch floor proceedings. Did you feel like it was in any way different and possibly more instructive?
I think it was illuminating in the sense that, one, this was a week where Trump's mental capacity was definitely questioned. So it was a way for him to kind of be serious and present himself to the population outside of the confines of how the news is portraying him. And I do think that it, in terms of everybody thinks it's just partisan bickering, everybody yelling at each other in their own corners, it did show that you can have two sides come together and at least talk about things.
And we always try on the show to explain things. DACA, that's a acronym people hear all over this country, Deferred Adjudication for Childhood Arrivals. What does that mean? About 800,000 children who are no longer children in many cases. They've grown to adulthood. They're in school. They're trying to work. Brought here by parents without documentation. In almost every case, this is the only country they know, the only place they've ever lived. They have no country to go back to that they have any real attachment to. And yet their status is, if DACA is not dealt with legislatively, subject to possible deportation. This is a huge real-life issue for them, their families, and everyone that they know. And it's going to have to be bipartisan, will it not? I mean, isn't this going to have to be something that both sides figure out a way to get done?
Probably.
Can Republicans do it all by themselves?
No, probably not.
I mean, they're going to need Senate votes somewhere, right?
They are, especially in the Senate. They will definitely need votes. In the House, House Republicans, conservative House Republicans say, wait, we should not talk to Democrats. We should make a move on our own first and do something very conservative and see where the chips fall.
Like the president says, we'll see what happens.
Exactly. We'll see what happens. A lot of people do believe it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. There are those, the vast majority of Republicans believe it's their political imperative to do something here and to solve this problem, and legislate away. You know, the president stopped DACA. Congress needs to,
declaring it illegal as an executive action.
And the Congress wants to put it into law in some way, shape, or form. But the conservatives in the House and some in the Senate say it was illegal. We shouldn't. This
do
is
it.
Improper. We shouldn't be doing it.
And Anna, help our audience understand some of the backlash that's already begun to come the president's way. Wait a minute. Amnesty. You're giving something to these people who don't deserve it. The hardcore immigration supporters of President Trump from campaign and now are looking at us saying, wait a minute, this isn't what we bargained for. This is not what we support. And this is not what we expected.
I think actually, I mean, I've covered the immigration issue for a long time, and I think this is a real trap for Trump. I think the base feels like when they elected George H.W. Bush, when they elected George W. Bush in particular on immigration, that they both of those Republican presidents really disappointed them. And they thought Trump was going to be their guy. They're going to get the wall.
So totally different.
Totally different. And then now they're seeing him kind of waffle on this issue, right? Saying, okay, well, we really do need to get this figured out because you have, you know, more than 100 Fortune 100 company CEOs writing letters saying this needs to be fixed.
And then the president also says, and if we do this, we can maybe go to uncomprehensive, which then means to those Trump supporters, wait a minute, a path to citizenship, legal status for 10, 12, 14 million? What does that mean?
Dangerous politics for the president, I'll tell you that much. I mean, if you want to talk about something that depresses base turnout in a midterm election when base turnout's already going to be lower
and always
than
usual. Is.
Always is. Yeah. If you have a president and Republicans in Congress cut a big immigration deal in a midterm election year when the president's approval ratings are in the 30s and turnout's already going to be low on the Republican side, goodness gracious.
I mean, it's almost unfathomable.
We have lots of power brokers on the show. You've just listened to two of them, and two of the youngest and most important in Washington, D.C., Jake Sherman and Anna Palmer. They every day put together twice the Politico playbook. The Takeout Podcast thanks you.
Thank you. It was
thanks
fun.
Thanks so much. It was great.
Hope you enjoyed the show, folks. Come back next week.
For more from this week's conversation, download the Takeout Outtake Especial Tuesday morning, wherever you listen to your podcasts. The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari and Katiana Krachenko. CBSN production by Alex Zuckerman and Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, visit takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News Radio.